Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Tacheles. Mit Annette Riedel.
30 years after the wall has come down, when you look at Germany, does it surprise you one way or the other, or has it developed more or less exactly like you had anticipated then?
I have to say that nothing surprises me anymore, and nothing has developed exactly the way that I thought it would. I think that Germany itself has evolved very well. It didn't happen with the Soviet Union. Some of the issues that are out there now in terms of democracy and governance in Central and Eastern Europe, and most of all, the mess in the United States. I'm no longer a diplomat.
That's good to know. I can tell from what you're saying. Yeah. Let's stick with Germany a couple of minutes. At the time after the wall had come down and then the process of reunification started more or less right away, there were some people who were concerned that this Germany reunited may turn out too powerful again for comfort. Were you amongst those, and has it?
Well, I certainly was concerned about it as somebody who was born in Prague in 1937, and my history of understanding what happened during World War II. But I think that the power and role of Germany is something that is very important. And frankly, I wish Germany would occupy a role that was somewhat more forward-leaning now than kind of waiting to see what happens. And because I think that Europe itself needs to have a responsible and peaceful Germany, but one that in fact has a very forward-leaning role on economic and social issues.
But on the other hand, you're probably aware that within the European Union, some think that Germany is already too dominating in the concert of the 28-27.
For me, and as an American watching it, I think that the European Union needs to understand better what its role is, what happens in Brussels. But I also think that one of the things we've been watching is economic evolution in Central and Eastern Europe and in Europe generally. And that requires a Germany that is more involved, because I do think that the economic power and importance of Germany is something, and I say this as an American, is missing in some ways, and that I think Germany should be more forward-leaning on some of the economic issues.
Now, you're probably aware that there have been some very sad incidents of right-wing terrorism in Germany in recent years. There have been incidents of anti-Semitism as well. The coming up of a nationalist party with the AfD with Nazis amongst their ranks. And you're still thinking the liberal democracy is not at risk, at least here in Germany?
Well, I definitely hope it is not at risk. But I think also one of the things I have spent my life studying changes in countries and communism and Europe, etc. And one of the things that I did in 91 was to do a survey of all of Europe after the fall of the wall. And whatever I remember very much, we were in East Germany. And we had focus groups and things. And what was interesting was that there were a number of people who were afraid that they were going to lose their identity by becoming part of Germany. No Olympic team anymore, or what kind of security, what kinds of things. And it was interesting because the elements of that is partially what you're talking about that have come out in a different way. I am troubled generally about hyper-nationalism of any kind. My most recent book has this very bland title, Fascism, A Warning. And so I write about how fascism began with Mussolini and then with Hitler. And I think that one of the issues out there is always how do things that are small enlarge. So, for instance, the best quote in my book is actually from Mussolini, who said, if you pluck a chicken one feather at a time, nobody notices. So some of the feathers are the things that you're talking about.
And I do think plugged?
Right. And I think one needs to be very careful about what has created those particular people that vote the way they do. And one of the things that I have advocated, in America we have this saying, see something, say something. I have added to that, do something. And one of the do things is to talk to people with whom you disagree not just respect them, but talk to them. And I would like to know why those people are voting the way they are.
Were we maybe, in hindsight, a bit too careless and a bit too optimistic after the wall had come down, thinking, well, now we have a free, reunited Europe, peaceful, liberal democracy all over, and we didn't really see it coming? Or had you really anticipated that liberal democracy could be under fire in your lifetime again?
No, I never did. And I think that we were too euphoric. I think also we forgot something, which is that we dealt with a lot of elites, people that wanted to travel, that wanted to be able to talk, that wanted to have that freedom. I, as a Czech, Czechoslovakia had been a functioning democracy in the interwar period. Václav Havel was a great moral leader, and people were excited to deal with him and his fellows, but at the same time, I think we forgot about, quote, the ordinary people who felt that they had lost their identity, who in fact worried about what their jobs were going to be, what their security was going to be. I think most decision makers go back and think, what did we do wrong? And so I've thought about this an awful lot, and I do think is that we didn't take into consideration enough the lives of people who were completely disoriented as a result of what the changes were. And while they were happy to be able to speak freely, they also wanted to have security, a job, education.
When we look at some of the East and Central European countries, such as Poland or Hungary, namely Fidesz and PiS, Kaczyński and Orbán, the astounding thing is that they are being elected democratically, and all they do is trying to sort of undermine the liberal democracy. And the very same people who were on the streets, some of which risked their lives 30 years ago for freedom, are now voting for those who want to curb this very freedom. Can you understand
this?
I
find it hard to understand. I have to say, in the same period, 80s, frankly, is when I met Viktor Orban. He was everybody's favorite dissident. He created Fidesz. One of the problems with creating a party of the youth, as they get older, they want to change the youth party. But I think he was somebody that was basically motivated by power, was not understood. But I think the other thing that is out there that is worth mentioning, and that is nationalism. Patriotism is one thing, to be proud of one's identity. But if my identity hates your identity, then it's nationalism, and hyper-nationalism is very dangerous. So in the same survey I was talking about in 91, we asked, one of the questions we asked was, do you think a piece of your country is in the neighboring country? And I will never forget the answer of the Hungarians. 80% Hungarians thought a piece of their country was in the neighboring country. And what happened is Orban has taken advantage of that to press his own agenda and undermine others. And there's some words that don't go together. Illiberal democracy is an oxymoron. And I think we need to speak out more about that. There was mention of George Soros, of just kind of turning around somebody who has been, I think, in many ways, the dream behind a Europe whole and free, and to have him be criticized. Poland, I'm very surprised about. Poles had revolutions every 10 years, and Solidarity was a very important movement. And I think we need to watch as to what the signs are of the chicken being plucked. You can't make a bald chicken come back with feathers.
But haven't some democratic leaders also fallen short as far as the addressing of very existential questions is concerned, such as the ever-growing division between poor and rich people? Do they fall short of what they should be doing and therefore leaving room for those to step in and tell the people, we know?
I think there have been lapses in terms of, first of all, democracy is not easy. And also, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires people to participate in it, and the relationship of the social contract of the government fulfilling its responsibilities and the people fulfilling theirs. I think that not enough attention was paid, mainly because people thought it would happen semi-automatically, and it obviously didn't. I think that what people did not think about was the number of jobs that were lost through technology, and then also just generally kind of the responsibilities that the state has towards the people. And then there is always somebody out there that wants to take advantage of it. And for me, democracy, one of the arguments always, in college, et cetera, we all learn about what comes first, political development or economic development. They go together. Democracy has to deliver because people want to vote and eat. And so it is very important to keep that economic aspect out there, recognize maybe the health and education under a communist system wasn't great, but it existed.
Do we maybe have to accept that after the fall of the Iron Curtain, we just have a fuzzier political landscape? We don't have left-wing, right-wing, capitalism, communism as such anymore. And do we have to accept as Democrats that ultra-conservatism, for example, is part of the landscape? So as Democrats, we have to accept there are anti-Democrats among our ranks?
I think we need to note it, but not accept it. I think that what is important is to understand I don't like extremes, either extreme left or extreme right, and that there has to be a search for some kind of common answers. Compromise is not a bad word.
So it has been discredited much by interested forces.
Well, and I think deliberately. And then also, finding common answers takes a little bit longer than saying I'm a stable genius and I can figure everything out. By the way, Mussolini said he was a stable genius, and he also said that he would drain the swamp in Italian. So I think what I was trying to do, frankly, in my book is to try to figure out what had happened answering some of these questions. And I think partially there was unhappiness by some at the changes that happened at the end of the Cold War. And I think that not enough attention was paid to those. And so the changes as a result of technology, leaders who think they had the answers, jealousy about land, various aspects, and not enough attention was paid. But I do think I am opposed to extremes. I am a centrist. I do think that one can find common answers. They take time. And the truth is that fascism is not an ideology. It is a method for gaining power. And I think that one has to watch how that is being done.
Luckily, not every self-centered, pathologically self-confident narcissist who doesn't like to be opposed is a fascist. So where would you draw the line between
By
those
the way,
and
I do not
fascists?
Call the one that's in the United States a fascist. I think it is somebody who, in fact, is identifying, I also say communists are fascists, people that use power to undermine a system. And I think one has to call it out and basically say...
And he doesn't do it at the moment?
Well, I think that he's the... By the way, one of the rules I've just broken, which is that when you are a former diplomat in a foreign country, you don't criticize your own government. But I also think that it is very important for people abroad to understand that not all Americans agree with what is going on. I am, in fact, a refugee, and I have been very proud to sit behind a sign that says the United States because of the freedom it allows and because it is based on a value system where individuals are respected and where we believe in a rule of law. And if that's not going on, then I think it's important for those of us to talk about it and to admit it and to say that something has to be done and that democracy is not a spectator sport. And I now am going to spend a lot of time getting people to vote and to understand what has gone on, because I happen to believe the U.S. Needs to be present. When the U.S. is not present in the international system does not work. The U.S. cannot be absent without leave, AWOL. We need to be partners with countries, and Germany is one of our best partners.
I will get back to this. Let us stay for a second with fascism again. We have Russia's Putin, we have North Korea's Kim Jong-un, we have Egypt's Assisi, Syria's Assad, Venezuela's Maduro, Brazil's Bolsonaro, Hungary's Orbán, Turkey's Erdogan, to just name the most notorious. but not, again, not all of them are fascists. And when and how does populism, right-wing populism, most of the time, develop into fascism, or is going through this process?
I do think the process, I think, is that there are problems in a society. Italy, for instance, after the end of World War I, had fought on the Allied side but was not being recognized for what they had done, and there were economic issues, and the system as it was set up couldn't deal with it, and Mussolini was somebody that had a capability of talking to groups and crowds. And by the way, what I think is very interesting, both Mussolini and Hitler came to power by constitutional means. Also, the countries that you named, the people were elected, which is why we need to watch what happens. So the process is whereby this ex-leader decides to identify himself with one group at the expense of another, so that it is the other's fault. It's the scapegoating. What also has to be watched is when the leader thinks that he's above the law, that the laws apply to other people. And by the way, the press has to play, in a democracy, a free press is the basis of it. And I think that there are some criticisms of the press, frankly, and it's true in the United States in a number of ways, but I think it's a mistake to call the press the enemy of the people. So there cannot be above the law. I have not called anybody except Mussolini and Hitler a fascist in my book. I have pointed out the steps that are there. I think that somebody who comes pretty close to being a fascist is Putin, who thinks he's above the law, who's using nationalism, who is using information in a way to undermine other countries. What I was trying to point out were the steps, the process, and the only way to undo it is for people to call it out, to also run for office or support those that do. There's no book or speech ever given in the United States that doesn't quote a great writer, Robert Frost. Robert Frost said, "The older I am, the younger are my teachers." And I really do think that what some of the young people in all our countries are doing needs to be part of the recognition that we need to change direction.
I would like to segue here into more classical international politics issues for a little while that I'd like to analyze with you. Generally speaking, you've already mentioned it just a minute ago, you'd agree that the U.S. is at present going away from interventionalism, but also from internationalism to a certain extent. The interventionalism, maybe one can understand, because it's never been a very comfortable role for the U.S. They'd be loath if they got involved, and they'd be loath if they didn't. So maybe there's some merits in going away from this approach.
And we're all, you know, creations of our background. So having seen what went on when not enough attention was paid before World War II, and I saw what was going on in the Balkans, and I was in a position to work with President Clinton on intervention. And the number of people at this conference that have come up and said, thank God that the United States got involved in the Balkans. The job isn't over, but I do think, and it was NATO that did it, that there needs to be a way of seeing when bad things are happening in countries and there is a possibility to have some kind of a role to improve the situation through organized, like NATO or the United Nations. It's worth thinking about. I don't think the world is better off with the United States just thinking that we have no responsibilities.
But we do have to accept that after 7 decades that the U.S. more or less guaranteed the security of Europe, that this is not longer the case, will not be much longer the case, has started this development already before Donald Trump. You've already mentioned that you'd like Germany to act more assertive or more proactive on the international scene. Would you like Germany to also become, again, a military power, maybe reined in, framed in by the EU?
I wouldn't put it that way, but I do think that what has to happen is that NATO is a partnership and set up in a way, and again, things that people go over, and, you know, did you make the right decision? there are plenty of people who come up to me and criticize me for being one of the people that expanded NATO. Imagine if we hadn't. Imagine if that was no man land now in terms of what was going on. And I do think that NATO is not a charitable foundation. It is a partnership. And I think various partners have to do their job, not just in terms of paying what was agreed to, 2% of budget for their own defense, but also to participate when it's necessary, when bad things happen in other countries. I would like to see Germany be more active in terms of some of the activities, but I would like to see others also. I would not like to see NATO be pulled apart and stop existing. I think that it's very important. I think that Russia is a threat in different ways, and I think that there's an awful lot that needs to be done, again, in partnership. And for me, just to repeat, the U.S. needs to be present. President Clinton was the first one to say we were, a nation that had to be there all the time. And I think that he said we're indispensable. I just said it so often it became identified with me. But there's nothing about the word indispensable that says alone. It just means that we need to be engaged in partnership with others. By the way, Americans don't like the word multilateralism. It has too many syllables and it ends in an ism. But basically, it's just partnership. And I think that U.S. and Europe are the strongest partners, but we all have to do our share and not blame each other for different things, but to work together in what is the world's not only strongest military alliance, but one of democracies that is also a very important part of it.
But you wishing the EU, including Germany, to become more active does not mean that you'd be in favor of it or them becoming strategically independent.
No, I think it's the partnership. But I think that partnerships are a force multiplier, and people do and countries do what they can to contribute, and there are different aspects of it, but it's not simple. I think this is an odd time. I'm often asked if I'm an optimist or a pessimist. I'm an optimist who worries a lot, and I worry that we're not seeing the things that are going on, that we're missing an opportunity in this very changeable time to develop institutional structures where we do our share. The new wall is disinformation and the militarization of disinformation. And I think that's one that we have to figure out how to deal with together. It's not anything that one country can do by itself.
Let me just talk a few minutes about Iran gradually shedding its commitments under the nuclear deal. Do you think the deal curbing the nuclear powers or potential nuclear power of Iran is dead, or can it be revitalized?
Well, it all depends on what happens next year. I happen to think that the JCPOA was a good agreement. And one of the things, by the way, that I think as a former diplomat, what happens is you can't always solve all the problems with a negotiation. It was incomplete in many different ways.
Not addressing the missile programs, not addressing the aggressiveness in the region.
Right. But you have to, I mean, there are two ways to negotiate. Either you put everything on the table that's a problem and see if you can do things back and forth, or you begin to take pieces of it. And I thought that what we were most threatened with, all of us, is the potential nuclear power of Iran. And so I think it was a good deal and worth keeping. I think that by having the United States pull out gives an excuse, which is what has just happened. The Iranians are using their centrifuges. Again, the question is whether the IAEA is going to be able to go in or out. So I think it was a very, very big mistake. I do think, depending upon what happens and where the Iranians are, it needs to be returned to. But we need to deal with nuclear proliferation generally. We need to figure out what happens to arms control agreements. The Russians were cheating on the INF, but I think the U.S. pulling out gave them an excuse. I think we need to figure out what happens on the new START treaty that is going to expire.
So you still believe in diplomacy, I can tell.
Definitely believe in diplomacy.
I I cannot let you go without mentioning a few domestic U.S. issues. Impeachment is underway. It's on the grounds that Donald Trump might have abused his power in the Ukraine in the context of the son of his political rival being involved in business there, and he wants the Ukrainians to investigate and therefore allegedly has misheld some 400 million military aid. These are the facts on the ground. What can be achieved with this impeachment process, knowing that he will not be impeached in the end, because it's a political thing and it would take a two-thirds majority in the Senate?
I think one of the things that I think is important to recognize is our Constitution. And Article 1 gives power to Congress and responsibilities and duties. And in Article 2, it's about the power of the executive branch. And there was concern among those writing the Constitution about overwhelming power of the executive. My feeling is that the members of Congress feel a responsibility, given the kind of facts that are coming out.
Only the Democrats amongst them.
Well, that's their problem. I mean, I think the Republicans, they have an overly political view of it, and I think that they will pay for it in the end. But I do think that it's important to go forward with the inquiry. And I'm going to say something else. You asked about diplomats. I think that what is happening at the moment in the criticism, unfair, of the American diplomatic service and people that have served their country as diplomats is outrageous. These are people that are loyal to their jobs. They are doing a very difficult job. I think the atmosphere is ugly and nasty. I do wish that it was possible for the Congress to deal with a lot of legislation that they have to, because some of the things that are going on need to be dealt with. But I do think it is the responsibility of Congress to examine this. They are doing that, and I support that.
And you're not concerned that there's going to be an incredible muckraking there that will spill into the beginning campaigns of the presidential election?
It will happen no matter what. That is what's going on. And I it is very troubling. It is very hard to watch what is going on. I think it is very hard to watch the kind of things that are going on. But I do think that the Congress has a job to do. I wish they would do it. I wish the press were, in fact, not talking only about that, but that there are other things going on. But I think we are a democracy, and the Congress is doing what it is demanded of it.
Would you advise us here in the audience and in Germany to better brace ourselves for another 4 years of the ways of the man in the White House?
I can't predict that, but I really do think that what we need to brace ourselves for are increasingly complicated relationships between the United States and Europe. And I have considered myself, frankly, as kind of the epitome of the Euro-Atlantic relationship. I happen to have been born here and only accidentally raised as an American. I'm a very proud American, and I do think that the U.S. has a role to play. But I think Europe does too, and we have made a mistake in not cherishing that relationship and working on it because things change. And then the part, I know some Europeans were irritated at President Obama when he rebalanced to Asia, at which point I said, people need to remember that the U.S. is not monogamous. We are an Atlantic and a Pacific power and have responsibilities in both places. But our relationship with Europe is a key one. But a relationship is a two-way thing, and the Europeans need to help, too.
I will quote, towards the end of our conversation, something the European newspaper Die Welt, the World, wrote about the candidates of the Democrats. Last time I checked, there were 16 remaining. And they're saying this list is a catastrophe. They're too old, too white, too liberal. So I won't get you to endorse any of those candidates, that's as well. But to profile, what does it take? Who can take on this man in the White House?
Well, I think it is somebody that will tell the truth, somebody that has the energy and experience and wisdom to do various parts of it, who is prepared for what is very hard. I think it is a very hard job, having watched a couple of presidents or worked for several of them. It requires somebody that has two parts to his or her brain, who can deal with domestic issues and foreign policy issues. And sometimes that is not possible in terms of people's interests. But I think it's time for a very committed and thoughtful president who is able to find the common answers. I think the part that worries me is, as I've said earlier, I'm neither an extreme lefty or an extreme righty. And I think that we need a candidate and a president who can bring people together. Trump is not the cause of everything. He is the result of things that were a problem. And we need to deal with those, and that's what has to be recognized.
I'm not going to ask you who you're thinking of, because if I apply all you've said, I can't see those qualities in any of the 16 combined, that is. Okay, you're not going to comment.
I am not. I mean, I have deliberately decided. I have worked in many different campaigns, and I think that we have a process that we're going through, and sometimes it's a surprise, sometimes it isn't. But I do think that the issues out there are unbelievably difficult, and more difficult than usual, because I think we have had a time that I think has been disastrous for America and for the world, frankly, and that this is not going to be simple. But I think that we need to have an election where civilized discussion. I do believe that it's important to find out why people vote the way they do. What is the reason behind it? Is there some way to have a logical discussion and respect them? I don't think everybody is somebody, you know, that doesn't think about it. And I welcome the opportunity of going around and trying to find out what the issue is. Why? I tell this story. One of my favorite activities when I was secretary, or even now, is to hand people their naturalization certificates. So the first time I did it was July 4th, 2000, at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home. Since I had his job, I thought I could do this. So I gave this man his naturalization certificate, and he walks away and he says, "You know what? Can you imagine I'm a refugee and I just got my naturalization certificate from the Secretary of State?" So I went up to him and I said, "Can you imagine that a refugee is Secretary of State?" And America has been a country that has welcomed its diversity, that has seen its responsibility in the world, that has abided by the rule of law, and has tried to be helpful to those that need help. I want to see an America like that again. I want an America that is respected.
Leading me to my very last question, being a refugee, you could not have become president of the United States. That's unconstitutional. Had you ever regretted that fact sometime in your life?
No, because I don't have a brain that can deal with domestic policy and foreign policy. I did develop a very close relationship with Václav Havel. And as my last trip to the Czech Republic, it was a crazy trip, and my staff was saying, "I don't understand what we're doing here, because they have arranged for you to go to all these little towns and everything." And I said, "I don't know what." But anyway, I'm there with Václav Havel. And in the middle of it, he says, "I would like Madeleine to follow me as president." And I kind of, trying not to be rude, said, "I'm an American." And I was trying to figure out what had happened. He was identifying me with Thomas Garrig Masaryk. And I was going, since he was a playwright, he was arranging that I go to all the little towns that were associated with that, with his history. And I do think that I don't regret saying no to that, but I do think I am a proud American of Czech birth.
Thank you very much, Madeleine Albright.